had added this to my calendar in the wrong time zone, so I'm sorry for that. This has never happened to me before, but thank you for coming. I know this is the last session of the day, and it's Friday, and tomorrow's a holiday, so hopefully we can get some good value out of this session. This session is normally one that I give at the start of the conference because it's an overview of everything that we do across application lifecycle management in the Visual Studio 2010 release. And it's really designed to whet your appetite for other sessions that may follow on. For whatever reason, this session got scheduled at the end. So hopefully there's some things that maybe look interesting to you that we can kind of give you a quick sense for what we're doing around application lifecycle management. And then, of course, you can go on after that and learn more by watching the recordings of some other sessions you may have missed. And actually, that's the wrong presentation. One moment here. This is what happens when you show up late for your own session. Okay. Oh, I just didn't change the title. Okay, this is the right presentation. My apologies, folks. Okay, so I work on Visual Studio. I'm on Channel 9. If you're looking for a way to get started with application lifecycle management, you may want to check out my blog. I post all of my virtual machines, and all of my demos are all scripted, so you can go out there and follow along using the hands-on labs and get more of a hands-on sense for how the product works. And I've worked on two books as well. So what is application lifecycle management? It's kind of this fancy term that the industry analysts have come up with. We used to call this set of capabilities within Visual Studio Team System. You might remember that. We no longer use that term. Instead, we talk about the application lifecycle management capabilities of Visual Studio 2010, which is really long to have on my business card. But at the end of the day, it's quite simple. It really means that we are helping teams of people. You know, software isn't developed by individuals anymore. It's developed by teams of individuals that need to work together. And, of course, we want to help them build great software. So this means not only making sure that we are developing high-quality software that has as few as bugs as possible, but really building the right software. You know, we have a saying on our team, how often have you built what your customer asked for, not what they wanted? Right? And so part of application lifecycle management is being able to harvest the customer requirements in such a way that you can quickly produce an iteration of software that you can then hand back to them and say, is this what you expected us to be delivering? And then if not, then you can course correct over time. And then finally, we need to make sure that we're working together, that we're really eliminating those gaps between individuals, and we're eliminating waste in the system. So everything that we do, our charter at Microsoft within my team, is taking a look at those collaborative interactions and trying to figure out where can we reduce the amount of handoff time? Where can we eliminate the potential for things to actually change as you go from one person to another and lose the original intention or the original meaning? And so I was in England last year, and I was taking a look at their 20-pound note, and I saw Adam Smith on the front of this note. And now Adam Smith is a really famous economist. He's credited with a lot of things, but the one thing I didn't realize that he's credited with until I saw this is actually the division of labor. And so he recognized the economies of scale that you get when you can take individuals and have them specialize in a given task and then have them take the output of that individual task as the input for the next task. And that really led to a lot of what we refer to as the Industrial Revolution. And software development actually does take advantage of specialization of labor, as we know. You know, if we ask this room full of people, how many of us are web developers? Probably about half of the people would raise their hands. But then once we drill into that a little bit further, we would find out that he might be a web developer that specializes in back-end code that talks to the database, and she might be a web developer that actually spends all of her time focusing on CSS and the interactions between one storyboard pane to the next. And so there's lots of different people within that process. And unfortunately, developing software isn't quite the same as industrial development, where you take a look at, okay, if I'm building a bicycle and I need to get a tire, I can give you a spec and tell you exactly what that tire should look like. And if I need to get a bike frame, somebody else in here that can specialize in building bike frames can produce that. And then at the end of the day, once we get the bike frame and the bike tire, we can snap the two together. And as long as each person has done their job correctly in terms of building to that spec, everything should work together, right? If only software were that simple. Unfortunately, with software, we never build the same software twice. And so every time we have to completely reinvent the way that individuals are going to work together. We have to figure out what those goals are going to look like in the end. And we have to make sure that we're constantly communicating, constantly collaborating, and coming up with how we're going to get from point A to point B. And so with Visual Studio, our application lifecycle management strategy is really centered around Team Foundation Server. Team Foundation Server was built from the ground up in 2005, not only to be just a great source control solution, a great work item tracking solution, a build solution, but really meant to bring all of these different capabilities together so that we can start to achieve some synergies. And so if you take a look at the fact that you can store your source control within Team Foundation Server, I can then query a change that happened to a given file and ask, why was this file changed? Maybe it was to fix this bug, and we know that because we take a look at the bug work item and those two get linked together. In 2010, if you attended my last session, then you know that test cases are now stored as first-class citizens within Team Foundation Server as work items. That means I can query a requirement and say, for this requirement, how am I testing that? And then based on that particular test case, I can see for last night's build, how did that given test run go? Did it pass? Did it fail? Has it maybe not been run yet because it's a manual test? And you can start to draw all sorts of interesting conclusions as you look at this data, and I'll show you some reports in a minute that actually highlight some of that information. Now, the one thing that Team Foundation Server has a bad reputation for, based on our 2005 and our 2008 releases, is actually installing and setting up Team Foundation Server. So for those of you that may have installed Team Foundation Server 2005 and 2008, I apologize. I have no way of giving you that time back. But what I can tell you is that in 2010, we invested a lot in this release to make sure that it was very, very easy to set up and install Team Foundation Server. So if I drop back into this virtual machine here, this is a Team Foundation Server 2010 setup. And basically, when you first install this, it's as easy as that. So I basically insert the media and I say next, 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 and it's going to copy everything onto my machine. Once this is finished, so we'll come back to this in a minute or two. Once this is finished, it's a matter of launching one of four different wizards that I have the option to set this up on my machine. One of the things we added in 2010 is the ability for you to set up Team Foundation Server on a client operating system. So I can install this on Windows 7. I can install it on Windows Vista if I wanted to. Or, of course, you still have the traditional Windows Server setup. Another thing that we did is we made sure that if you have Visual Studio 2010, any level, whether that's professional or premium or ultimate, with an MSDN subscription, then you can go out and download your own copy of Team Foundation Server, and you can set that up either for your personal projects or for your entire team. And then another thing we did is we allowed you to make any of the components optional. So you don't have to set up SharePoint. You don't have to set up reporting if you don't want to. You can always tack on those services later on. You can even use SQL Server Express as part of this as well. So while this is doing the phase one of setup, I'll actually switch back and we'll revisit this in a few minutes. While this is copying, let me actually talk to you about some of the different ways within Microsoft that we use Team Foundation Server. So as you would imagine, the developer division where I work, where we actually build Team Foundation Server 2010, we make use of Team Foundation Server itself, and we dog food it, is like what we like to say. So this is the number of files we have stored in Team Foundation Server. This represents all the product work that we have going across Visual Studio, .NET Framework, all the different languages teams, C#, Visual Basic, Expression. So you can see the number of check-ins. I mean, just phenomenal. If you have projects this big, I would love to check them out, because here we have one project that has 3,600 unique users. So that's developers, testers, project managers, other stakeholders connecting Team Foundation Server within the last 30 days here. 17.3 terabytes of data. One of the really nice things here is that we actually use SQL Server under the covers to support Team Foundation Server. So that means we can just scale up based on the amount of disk space that you give us. And then we make Team Foundation Server available as an enterprise-wide service within Microsoft as well. So what that means is, if you are an employee at Microsoft and you work on a product team, whether it's a big product like Windows or a really small product team like maybe the Bing Maps team, which I think consists of something like 8 or 10 people, then you can go out to a central portal and you can request that a team project gets set up for you on one of our managed Team Foundation Server instances. And so this is what I've worked with a lot of companies on to actually implement within their organizations as well. So Dell, for example, they have about 2,000 developers worldwide that connect to a single Team Foundation Server instance back in Round Rock, Texas. And so they can go out and say, hey, we're going to start a new project here and connect back to that. So we're running about 40 instances within Microsoft. That's about 20,000 users today and 6,100 team projects, 7.9 million work items. There's some of the locations that we're running Team Foundation Server worldwide. One of the nice things about our architecture is that we allow you to actually set up proxies in each one of these locations. So if you're in India, for example, since all of our Team Foundation Server instances, for the most part, are based in Redmond, you can set up a Team Foundation Server source control proxy. And what that does is it actually goes across the wire for your first request. So if I'm the first person into the office and I get a file, it'll actually go across the wide area network, but then that file gets cached locally. So subsequent people in my office can get that from the proxy server. It really speeds up communication. In fact, our Team Foundation Server version control team is based in Raleigh, North Carolina, and for whatever reason, the office building that they work off has like a 1.5 megabyte pipe that they have to share with all the other companies that are there. And so they're especially motivated to make sure that they really have a great wide area network story there. Let me just get back to my virtual machine. Still deploying. So we'll get back to that in just a moment here. These are the different architectures you can employ with TFS 2010. This is the basic configuration that I'm setting up on my local machine where I have the database and the application tier on the same machine. The application tier really is what front-ends all of the client requests that come into it. So it's actually a web services layer that we then have an object model that talks to that layer. One of the things that I recently released is an OData wrapper for the client object model as well. So if anybody out there wants to build like a Windows Phone 7 or an Android experience or anything that really wants to talk back to Team Foundation Server, rather than write to the web service layer, I highly recommend you take a look at what we've done around OData, and then you can take that and consume it right within your application. So I actually talked to a company in Belgium called Ordina that they build a Windows Phone 7 application to talk to Team Foundation Server, and they've already published that to the marketplace based on that OData layer. And then another thing that I've seen people do is take that and actually embed TFS data right within their application. So let's say that you have a beta of a website that you're pushing out on your intranet portal, and you want people to be able to see any known issues for a particular page. Well, you can actually insert a query that then connects back to Team Foundation Server and then says, show me any known issues that are open against this particular page, and you scope that request to the area path within Team Foundation Server that represents that particular area of your function of your application. So it's a really cool approach there. As you want to scale this out, if you get beyond a few hundred users, you can actually put the data tier on another machine separate from the application tier. And in 2010, we also introduced the idea of being able to split out that application tier across multiple machines and load balance that as well. So you put a network load balancer on front of that, and that way if one of the machines happens to go down, either accidentally or on a scheduled maintenance cycle, then you could still have uptime for that entire cluster. The other nice thing about that is it also load balances the request, so you get better performance. The other thing that we did within 2010 on the database layer is we created the concept of a team project collection. And a team project collection is a way that you can contain multiple team projects. So a TPC contains one or more team projects. And then you can move those team project collections independently from one server to another. You can upgrade them independently. So when the next version of Team Foundation Server came out, if you want to wait before upgrading an entire cluster, you could do that just by upgrading individual team project collections. The other nice thing that's useful for is if any of you are consultants who work with customers and at the end of your project you want to give them all of the source control and the work items that you had so they can retain that history. A team project collection is a really nice way to do that. So you can basically export that from your server, hand it off to your customer, and they can load that within their own Team Foundation Server instance. And then, of course, you can take all these individual components and you can scale them out as well. So that's kind of the full enterprise deployment if you've got hundreds or thousands of users that need to talk to Team Foundation Server. Let's see if my basic configuration is ready for the next step. Sure enough, so it's already copied all the files that I need. The next phase of this is actually to configure Team Foundation Server 2010. And so we'll launch our configuration wizard, and we'll have the option of selecting that basic configuration if you want to. Of course, if you're upgrading from a previous release, you can just point at the upgrade configuration. But here we'll just do basic. Basic gives me source control, work item tracking, and test case management. What I don't get from the basic configuration is reporting and SharePoint integration. You can always go back and add that later on if you want to. But we find that most people, when they're just getting started with TFS, source control, work item tracking, and test case management are kind of the sweet spot features. The nice thing about this is I can take advantage of SQL Server Express here. And then for those of you that have set up TFS in the past, once again, I apologize. You can sometimes get yourself down a path where you're like 90% of the way there, and then you find out that you're missing some prerequisite or some update somewhere. So what we're doing here is we actually scan your machine to make sure that it's ready to install. And now I will go ahead and click on configure since all of that passed, and now it gets set up as you would expect. And then after I do that, then one of the really nice things I'll get here on my completed application here is an administration console. So here's my other machine where I already have Team Foundation Server set up. And we give you this administration console, which allows you to do a lot of the stuff that you used to have to use the command line for. But here you can see I can manage my team project collection. I can change service accounts on my applications here. I can go here and change the way that reporting works. I can set up lab management to talk back to an SCVMM machine and actually manage virtual machine labs for me. I can set up my build configuration, so I can say how many machines I want to have running automated builds for me and how many build agents I want to then connect back to those build controllers. So there's really a lot that you can do within here that in the past would have required you to drop to a command prompt and open up the administration guide. So that's how we're kind of enabling Team Foundation Server for everyone. Now, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and show you some features that are applied mainly for helping you understand complex branching and merging scenarios. So for those of you that are taking advantage of branching and merging to isolate work and to isolate teams into individual branches, one of the problems that you may be facing that I know that we face internally is having really complicated branching structures. You know, there's probably one person off in the corner of the room on your team that understands the history behind all the different branches you have in your source control. And, you know, if that person gets sick or finds a new job, then you're probably going to be in trouble when you try to figure out how you reverse engineer this structure. So one of the things we've done in this release is we've made it really easy for you to actually visualize your branching structure to understand the way that branches relate to one another. And then as you're looking at changes that are happening within one branch, how do you make sure that a given change finds its way into other parts of your system? So the first step, of course, is understanding that branching structure. And then let's give you some tools to help you merge that over into other parts. The second demo that I'll show you in this session is going to be modeling UML and architecture tooling. So we actually invested heavily in those tools in this release. We're finally giving you UML tools so that a lot of people have asked for in Visual Studio for a long, long time. And then we also give you architecture tools that you can use to decompose your application and understand all of the individual dependencies between classes, between assemblies, and so on and so forth. And I'll also show you how our architecture validation tooling allows you to ensure that the architectures that you come up with for your applications are actually adhered to as your developers go out and start checking in changes. So we've got some interesting tools that I'll show you here. So to start with, I'll open up Visual Studio and I'll go to a project that I've been working here on. It's Tailspin Toys. So it's just a web application. And if I show you this web application, I'll show you the bug that we're going to fix. At the bottom of this page, we actually have this menu bar down here. And I'm getting some calls from the marketing team because they noticed that none of these links actually work. And sure enough, if I follow investor relations and store locations, you can see that these pages just haven't been implemented yet. And let's say that this is a production system. So this is sitting out on a website right now. And so we're going to fast track a change into production. So I'm going to go make that change in the current branch where this source code lives. Obviously, you only want to do this for critical changes because this isn't going to go through our typical test branch and then make its way out to release. But I need to fix this change right away. Now, after I make that change, I then need to make sure that that change finds its way into my current iteration branch. Because I don't want to have a scenario where I'm implementing new features and I'm planning to roll out to production with that branch next Wednesday. But by pushing that out to production, I actually find myself in a situation where it doesn't include those changes that I'm fast-tracking to production. So I want to make sure I make it to production and then merge that over to the current iterations branch. I'm sure you can think of scenarios where you've had to do this within your own projects. So let me first start by understanding the branches that I have in my system. If you've used previous releases of Team Foundation Server, then you may notice that we have this new icon here, and that represents a branch relationship. So you can see I have folders and branches. So branches are basically first-class citizens. I can look at the properties for this branch, and they have some additional metadata. It shows me what the relationships are, so I can see that this was branched off of the main branch. I can set permissions on this branch, who's allowed to check changes in, that sort of thing. And the other thing I can do is I can visualize the entire hierarchy to understand how this branch relates to all the other branches in the system. So I'll just say the full hierarchy. And now I can see that iteration 2 is a child of main. It's a sibling of iteration 1 and production 1. So I told you we'd be making that change in production. So let me first go into my production branch, and we'll open up the page that defines that menu, which is broken. And that's going to be template.master. And I'm just going to make this change very quickly by commenting out those lines down there. So we'll just get rid of those broken menus. Next thing I'll do is I'll go ahead and check this into Team Foundation Server now that I've made that change. And we'll call this a fast-tracked fix to production to fix menu links. Go ahead and check that in. So now that change exists within production, but as I mentioned, we need to make sure that this also shows up within our iteration 2 node as well. So if I go back to my Source Control Explorer, I can actually look at history for the production branch, and I'm going to see that change that I just made. So there's fast-tracked fix to production. And one of the things I can do is I can actually track that change set, and it's going to ask me which branches I'm interested in. So here I'm interested in the production branch and iteration 2. Now, I could have also chosen to look at a given bug and tracked that as well. So sometimes you'll have multiple files that get checked in at different times. We call those change sets within Team Foundation Server. And so in order to fix a bug, it may have required 5 different change sets checked in by 5 different people. And you can track against that bug as well and visualize to see which of those change sets have shown up in individual branches. To keep our example simple here, I'm just tracking an individual change set. And so here you can see right away that this change was checked into production. Obviously, it's green, so that tells us that it's available there, but it hasn't yet shown up in main. So now what I can do is I can drag and drop this onto main. It's going to pop up my familiar branching and merging dialog. Now it's going to pin that change. So I can just say check into main. Now if I rerun this visualization, I can now see that it's starting to show up in main. Now if I move it to iteration 2, do the same thing. And we'll check that in. And so now we can see that it's actually merged across all of those different branches, which is great. That gives me the confidence to know that this change is now part of iteration 2 so that when I deploy that to production next week, we're not going to regress some functionality that we had to fix over in the production website. The other thing I can do is I can take a look at a timeline view as well. So here you can see exactly when those changes were merged in. And this can be useful if you have different branches that you may hand out releases for different customers. So if you have a release that you gave to your customer on Thursday, you can look here and say, hey, did that security fix that we made on Wednesday night actually make it into their build? And so maybe it went into to a different branch on Wednesday night, but it didn't actually get merged into their branch until Friday morning. So you know you now need to go out and generate a new build for that customer to make sure they get that security fix. The other thing that we do here is probably going to be a little bit subtle, but we'll see if it pops for a few of you here that may have used our annotate feature in the past. So if I look at iteration 2, for example, and I go back into that same file, under Tailspin Web, if I look at this template.master and I say annotate, if you're familiar with the blame tool from some other source control systems, it's basically the same thing. The idea is that I can look at any given block of lines, and I can determine who was the last person to make a change to these files, and then also look at when they made that change, and if they link that back to a work item, I could see why they made that change as well. So here I can see the initial check-in came from Abu on March 8th of last year. And if I scroll down here, you'll see down here at the bottom that these lines were commented out. And so here you can see that we actually made this change today to actually add that comment. And if I look at that, the one really nice thing about this, that again, it's kind of subtle, but that comment for this particular change, it's actually going back to the original time that I made that change. That was my original comment where I said I'm fast-tracking this change into production. Because if you use 2008 or other version control systems, often it will just tell you that this change came because it was merged from this particular branch. And oftentimes in this branching strategy, at least, it's going to say this was merged from main. But that's totally irrelevant to us. We don't know why this was originally made. So we're now using the version control history appropriately to tell you this is why we originally made this change. And if that was linked back to a bug fix, you're going to see that here. So again, if you're familiar with TFS and you've been using 2008 for a while, that's something that I think you'll really appreciate. The other thing I wanted to show you here is related to our architecture tooling. So let me just open up my solution here. And, you know, a common problem is you inherit a code base and you want to understand how that code base actually breaks down. Or maybe you're proposing a change and you want to understand, will this change that I'm making over here have an impact on other parts of the system? Am I going to introduce additional entropy that I don't want to introduce into the system by making this change? And a big part of that is trying to understand the existing architecture of your system. And I don't know about you, but a lot of the projects I've worked on don't do a good job of documenting as they go. And so here what we can do is we can actually dynamically generate an assembly graph that shows me, or a dependency graph that shows me how one assembly or one class relates to one another. So if I generate by, let's say, assembly, it's now going to reverse engineer my existing code and spit out a diagram that's based on a new standard we call DGML. And that's an open standard that people can actually build other tooling on top of as well. So there have been some interesting cases where people have taken this and then built other tooling on top of this to display the data in interesting ways. But in just a moment here, you'll see the way that all of the assemblies in my class not only relate to one another within my solution, but they also can have links to dependencies that are in the .NET framework that I may not even have access to the source control for. But it's nice to be able to see that visual relationship so that if I'm migrating this to the next version of the .NET framework, I'll be able to take that into consideration. So this is almost done here. So here you can see that that I've got this broken down by the different DLLs. In fact, we make the strength of the line thicker if there's a bigger dependency from one to another. So if more classes within this assembly talk to other classes, then you can visually get a sense for that just by the size of those lines. Here you can see I can expand the externals here, and then this is going to show me on a per DLL basis, which files within the .NET framework I don't have access to, but let me see, I forgot to plug in my mouse. If I zoom in here, you can see mscorelib.dll. One of the nice things is that I can actually prune this graph as I go. So if I want to, I can delete mscorelib from here. Obviously, you would never do that on your real system, but this is just a DGML diagram. And so I have two different versions of that because I have multiple versions of the .NET framework. So system.dll, you know, maybe I'm not interested in that. Of course, that's going to appear in every .NET framework application I build. I think there's another version of that somewhere in here. And then what I can do is I can take this container, and now let's say that I wanted to see it as it relates individually to the rest of the files in my project. I can right-click on this and say group. Remove group, and now it's actually put that in the context of the rest of my diagram. Now, of course, I've lost the visual indication of which ones are still external, so you can come into node properties, and you can say is external, and maybe I want to set the background color of anything that's external to, oops, wrong one. Let's say orange in light of the holiday tomorrow. And so now I can quickly see at a glance, these are how the assemblies within my solution relate to other assemblies that may be third party or I don't have access to the source code for. And so this can become some living documentation. It may also become part of the way that you plan your architecture moving forward. So I can mark this up, I can add comments, I can check this in along with a work item to say, hey, we actually need to remove the dependency from this particular class and here's what we mean, here's how all the files relate to that. I can print this to XPF or PDF if I want to. So it's a really nice tool for doing that. The other thing that we introduced is UML diagrams. So if I open up my project again, and if I look at my modeling project, you can see an example of some of the diagrams we have. We have an activity diagram. So all the major UML diagrams are in here. Class diagram, use case diagram. In fact, I could point at a given method within my application, and I could say generate a sequence diagram for me dynamically. So how often do we inherit source code and we're trying to figure it out, or maybe even source code we wrote 6 months ago that may as well have been inherited, and we're trying to figure out how it operates, and you set all these, you know, breakpoints, and you F5 it, and you go to definition. Well, now you can just generate a sequence diagram right from here and see on a swim lane by swim lane basis exactly how the calls relate to one another. So that's really, really nice. The other thing we did is we introduced layer diagramming within the product in 2010. So, you know, layer diagram, of course, is nothing special in and of itself. We've all drawn these on whiteboards and said, you know, we have a model view controller architecture, so this is how the individual classes are going to relate to one another, and you can have a one-way dependency where you can call from one layer into another, and that's represented by having an arrow in one direction, and so you can see that in my layer diagram. But this is more functional than just a pretty diagram because we actually tie this back to your source control as well. So what you can do is you can actually take this diagram And you'll notice here that under controllers, I've already taken some classes from my solution, and I've drag and dropped those onto this diagram to say that these are the classes that are actually representative of this particular diagram. And now, what I can do is right-click and say validate this architecture, and it's going to inspect those dependencies, and it's going to give me a report that says whether or not my existing source code violates the layer diagram. So how often do we generate these layer diagrams and they go in a conference whiteboard or they get printed out and put on people's cubicles and that's the last time they look at them, right? And then pretty soon you notice you have all this entropy and, you know, you change one thing that you don't expect to break another part of your system, and sure enough it does break it and you're trying to figure out why. Well, this type of tool can now give you some insights into why that's happening. And so here you can see that, you know, we're making some calls from one part of the diagram into the other that we shouldn't. You can also right-click here and say generate dependencies, which will then change this diagram to make it look like your existing code. So if I say generate dependencies, it's kind of subtle here, the change it's going to make, but you may have noticed that some of these at the top became bidirectional dependencies, whereas before they were one way. And so that's telling me that this is my existing code as it relates to this type of layer diagram. So you can use this in a couple of different ways. One is you can just run it right from within Visual Studio anytime you want to inspect your architecture. And that's one good way to do it. But another thing you can do is you can actually set this up as part of your build system as well. So imagine having the ability to have a developer check in code and then get a warning or an error message that says whether or not a change they just made actually broke a dependency that you've modeled within your layer diagram. The other really cool thing we've done in 2010 is we've enhanced our build engine so that you can take advantage of what we call gated check-ins. So as your teams get bigger and bigger and bigger, even if you have the best developers in the world, if you have 30 people on a development team and each one of those people only breaks the build once a month, which would be pretty good, right? You're getting a broken build every single day on average, right? And so at Microsoft, we've solved this problem internally for a few years by having what we call gauntlet check-ins. The idea is that before my change gets committed to a source control repository, I want to actually build it somewhere and then run a set of verification tests. Maybe those are unit tests. Maybe it's an architecture diagram validation like what you see here. And only if it passes those tests can it be checked in. If it can't pass those tests, then we send an alert back to the developer and say, you need to fix this line of code, or you regress some functionality from the last build, and you need to fix that before it becomes available. So, you know, if you're that guy, and I've been that guy, who's always breaking the build and having to buy beer and pizza for the rest of the team, you'll love this feature because it means you can never break the build again. So to enable that team build definition, It's pretty straightforward. You basically just come down to Team Foundation's servers interface here in Team Explorer, and then you open up your build definition. And then you just change the trigger so that it's a gated check-in. And now by making it a gated check-in, it's automatically going to build this, make sure that it passes all the verification tests before committing it back to source control. So that's really nice. In the interest of time, I won't do that, but it basically gives you a nice experience where it says, hey, before we check this in, we're going to build it, and then you can go to lunch and come back, and it'll give you a toast that says whether or not the build completed successfully. So do you recognize that guy? I like to say that he's the grandfather of Team Foundation Server. This is Lord Kelvin, and he was responsible, of course, for many things such as inventing the Kelvin scale, but he's often quoted with, you cannot manage what you cannot measure. And I think it's really insightful to say, you know, software development projects are really, really complex. And as we start making changes to try to improve the flow and try to improve the quality of our work, it's really difficult to know if we're actually having a good effect on the system and the investments we're putting forward are actually giving us a positive return if we can't, at the end of the day, measure how we're doing against previous iterations and against last week and see how those efforts move through the system. So as I mentioned, you know, Team Foundation Server was really built from the ground up to bring all these artifacts, source control, work items, test cases, requirements, builds, everything under one roof. And by doing that, we start to light up some really interesting reports that you can start looking at in real time. This is one that I like to call the Steven Sinofsky report. You might know that Steven Sinofsky runs the Windows division at Microsoft. What a lot of people don't know is that Windows 7 was actually built by using an early release of Team Foundation Server's 2010's work item tracking system. So one of the big things that we added in the 2010 release is we introduced hierarchical work items. A lot of people were asking for this, including the Windows division. And the idea with a hierarchical work item is I can start with a user story, for example, or a requirement or a feature or whatever you call it on your team is okay. But I can then take that top-level requirement, what we're delivering to the customer, and I can break that down into the work that's going to be required for my team to go implement that. So we take a user story, we create child tasks that then roll up into that user story. And then from there, you can link that back to your test plan, and you can say, how do my test cases relate to my requirements? You know, did these tests pass last week? Are they passing this morning? And so now, as Steven Sinofsky, I can open up my dashboard in the morning, and I can get a report that looks something like this, that says, how am I doing against my features that I care about? And so, for example, I can look at this second one here, and obviously this isn't Windows. This is an e-commerce application. And it says, as a customer, I want to track my order history. And okay, that's a feature I care about. You know, if you expand one of these, it can show you the child tasks that go into creating that. And here I can see that it's 79% done. You know, that's okay, right? That means the developers have said, I've checked in 79% of the code, or, you know, this was going to take me 100 hours, and I've completed about 80 hours of that. That gives me one indication of how this feature is progressing. But then when I look at the other dimension of this, I see that I actually have zero tests that are written for this given feature. So what good is it to know that the developer's done if we have no confidence that it's actually working? No offense to the developer, of course, but we don't actually have any tests to tell us whether or not this is passing. And so here I can see that the line above it, we have three tests for this other user story, but many of those tests either haven't been run or aren't passing. So it gives us a really nice multi-dimensional view to help me understand exactly how my system is going in real time, and I can start to make decisions and ask the questions I need in order to understand where my project is at. Here's another one. When you set up Team Foundation Server, you have the option of setting up a SharePoint dashboard along with that. If you take advantage of SharePoint Server, then you actually get a really nice, rich, multi-dimensional dashboard that shows you all of these reports here. If you use SharePoint Foundation, you still get some of those reports. You can access all of the reports directly. They just don't surface as the web parts that that we show you here. So if you're using SharePoint Server, you get a really nice dashboard experience. But if not, you can still access the reports right from within Visual Studio or Excel or other mechanisms. So what you're looking at here is the bug report that shows me over time how my bugs are moving through the system. The next one here is actually pretty interesting. This shows me my code coverage, which means how are my tests actually hitting the lines of code within my solution. And so good code coverage would be, you know, increasingly high, although that's not the only metric you want to use, because sometimes if you tell developers to go increase their code coverage, you know, you can write tests in such a way that they impact every line of code but don't actually tell you whether or not the code is working, right? So it's one indicator, but it's not the be-all, end-all indicator to tell you whether or not you have a good quality plan in place. Code churn tells you how many of those lines of code are changing on a daily basis. So at Microsoft, we have the idea of a ship room. You probably have something similar within your organization. You know, 3 months before we hit a major release, maybe that's a beta or an RTM, then we allow developers just to really do whatever they want in the source code, and eventually those features start to merge, and then maybe 2 months out before that release, we have everyone come into a room called ship room with representatives from each one of the teams. And during this period of time, we call it tell mode, because you show up and you tell other people on the team what it is that you're changing. Obviously, if you're on the .NET Framework team and you're changing something in the base class library, people need to listen up, because they're probably taking advantage of what you're using, and they have a dependency, so they need to understand the changes you're making. Once we get out to be maybe a month out from a release, we shift gears into what's called ask mode. With Ask Mode, we are having each one of those team members show up in the same ship room every morning, but before checking their changes in, they're saying, here's are the changes we would like to make. Here's why we're making these changes. You know, maybe it's a security fix that we need to make, or maybe, you know, 40% of our customers asked for this, and here's the data about why it's important to them. And then sometimes we get down to the point of saying, here are the individual lines of code that we're going to change to make this happen. And so sometimes they fire up Visual Studio within these shiproom meetings, and you have vice presidents doing code reviews. It's kind of interesting. But the idea is that as you get towards the end of your release, you should be reducing the amount of code that you're changing on a day-to-day basis. And so a report like this with code churn can actually show you, hey, you know, developers came in over the weekend and they were working hard to finish up their features, but they made a lot of changes to code, and we have to give this to a customer on Monday. This is probably not a good sign because those changes aren't getting tested. So again, just another look at things that you might uncover. This is a really interesting view because it shows you the amount of remaining work in your system. And at first blush, you may look at this and say, well, we're on track. You know, we've got this task burned down and we're reducing the amount of hours that are remaining in the system. And if you follow the trend line out to next week, then looks like we're on track to deliver to the customer. That's great. You know, and so you may decide that's all right until you look down at the next report and you see that we actually haven't closed out any user stories. You know, what that means is we're doing a little bit of work over here, we're doing a little bit of work over here, a little bit of work over here, and it might be, you know, Friday afternoon by the time any given user story is working, and that doesn't give our test team enough time to actually run through their tests. And so a report like this can signal to you that you need to have the developers focus on getting, you know, one, maybe two of those user stories really completed so that the test team can focus on testing that experience. And then you can, you know, finish up the rest of the work later, but at least give that information to the test team so that they can start their flow and everybody can have a good shot at delivering a great experience. Another thing we did in the 2005 and 2008 release is we released a web access for Team Foundation Server. So you don't have to use Visual Studio. You don't have to use Excel or Project. You can actually connect to work items and to reports straight from within a web access client. That's really nice if you're a stakeholder who might just be filing bugs and maybe doesn't even own a copy of Visual Studio. One of the things that people asked us for is the ability to create their own custom dashboards as well. And so we took a lot of those components from web access and we turned them into web parts. And now if you use SharePoint, you can actually just create your own web parts for a portal maybe that you give to your customers and say, hey, here's a list of all the known issues and bugs for that particular application that you're using, or here's a bug form that you can use to fill out as you're dog fooding and trying out that sample application. And there's some others in here, like here's the test plan progress. So in my last session this afternoon, I showed you how you can break your work down into multiple test plans and track the way your test cases and your requirements are getting better and better over time, we hope. And so these types of reports start to light up if you use those test plans. And now I can look at an individual iteration and say, you know, how well are those requirements being tested? So now let me show you how project management works within Team Foundation Server. One of the really nice things that we get by being based... I need to close that VM. I keep opening the wrong one. One of the really nice things we get by having broken down all of the work items into this work item hierarchy is it actually makes it much easier for us to do project management, decompose our work over time, to groom our backlogs like you might if you're running an agile process like Scrum, and then to actually plan our iterations and decide how much capacity can we take on, who's actually doing this work. So if I look at my work items here, I can see that I have a list of all of the work that's currently on my product backlog. And so this is just a prioritized list that I've worked with my customer to come up with. You're probably using something similar on your team. You can see that there's some work that I've done in iteration one already. Iteration two is currently active, but I'm getting towards the end of iteration two and I need to figure out what iteration three looks like. And so I can manage everything right within Visual Studio, but one of the things I like to do is actually manage this work within Excel. And so we give you these new Excel-bound workbooks that make it really easy for you to actually open up this data and quickly work with it within Microsoft Excel. So if I open up my product planning worksheet, just going to open Excel. And you might open this up within the course of a stand-up meeting or a planning meeting that you have within the rest of your team. One of the nice things you can do here is you can make these changes, and they don't actually get persisted to Team Foundation Server until you've actually said, yes, I'm happy with this plan. So we'll edit this workbook, and this is the same data I was just looking at here. So here you can see I've got iteration 1, iteration 2, and now I'm on to iteration 3. Well, one of the first questions I need to answer is, how much work can I actually take on in iteration 3? Now, I haven't broken down this work yet. I haven't decomposed it into the individual tasks I need to go implement. But we have done a planning exercise, maybe using a planning poker if you're familiar with that. And we've gone around the room and we've kind of given some rough size estimates to the user stories that are in here. So with that information, I know that this one is 6 story points. This one's 2 story points. So it's kind of a rough order of magnitude scale for me to use to size this information. And so if we hop over to iterations, you can actually see all the iterations I've planned to date. This is iteration 1, iteration 2. And now we're going to be planning iteration 3, which is going to be a 1-week iteration from 5.2 to 5.6. And we have 3 people working on it. And so at this point, I now need to take on the amount of story points that I'm comfortable with. In the last iteration, I also had 3 people working for five days, and they were able to take on about 14 story points. So I feel like that's a pretty good sweet spot for me. So I'll go back into my product backlog, and I'll just start assigning work to this iteration here. And here you can see that it's starting to get to where I want it to be, so let's assign 1 more. And now that was too big. So I'm going to pop that story point, or that user story, back onto the backlog. And instead, I'm going to pick up another one. If I look here, you know, that one's 7 story points. This one's 4. That looks to be about the right size. So let's try to do that work as well. If I come to iterations, there you can see that feels about right to me. So once we're happy with this, we can go to the team tab and we can say publish, and that's going to now push it back to Team Foundation Server. We can refresh that data, and you can see that this is now slated for iteration 3. But I haven't started to decompose this work yet. I don't know the individual tasks that go into realizing these user stories, and I don't know from an individual basis who in my team is going to do what work. So the next thing I want to do is actually a sprint planning exercise, and we give you a worksheet for that as well. So if I open up the iteration backlog, this will do basically the same thing. So this is going to open up an Excel-bound workbook, which then looks at any of the work that we have within iteration 3 and allows us to quickly break that down. When you open up these workbooks, one of the first things that you'll usually want to do is make sure you click on refresh, and that's actually what's going to trigger the data to be repopulated within here. And here you can see that I have some of this work already broken down. So the top 3 user stories, I've already broken those into their child tasks. And so we actually represent that by just having a hierarchy on the next line. And I would now want to break down this last one that I've added that I haven't had a chance to break down yet. And so I'll add a few child stories or child tasks. And I'll save you from watching me type by just doing some copy and paste here. So here I've created some titles for these tasks. You know, I want to design the password reset UI. I want to implement that. I've allocated it to some developers who I think should have the ability to take this on, and I've given it some work estimation. So this is how many hours or days we expect it's going to take for these people to work on it. The scale we use actually in here is hours to start with, but if you want to change it to days, that's pretty straightforward to do. Again, I need to come in and define my iteration dates. In the next release, we're actually making this strongly typed so that you can define it once within Team Foundation Server, and then we know what the iteration looks like. You won't have to put it back into these workbooks anymore. And then if I come into my capacity tab, I can say who is working on this and how many hours a day do each of them work. So this is time on task, so not time checking email, having lunch, updating Facebook. Oh, that's why. The other thing I need to do is actually assign the rest of these tasks to iteration 3. I was wondering why they didn't have any work to do. Okay, so now you can quickly see in real time that this is how much work is currently allocated to these folks. And so I'm a little bit worried about April because she's our dev lead and we can't allow her to slip behind if she has to help other people on the team. The other thing that is going to happen here is April comes to us and says, you know what, I'm just working too hard. I need to take a vacation next week. So she's going to be gone. Hopefully she's not looking for a new job. So she's gone for 2 days, and we also have a company meeting on Monday, so no work is going to get done. So now if I go back to my capacity tab, I'm starting to get worried, right? And so it looks like Abu and Doris still have some spare capacity, so what I can do is go back to the iteration backlog and revisit some of the work that's currently assigned to April, and let's say that Abu is going to take that, and Doris volunteers to take this one. Now if I look at my capacity, I actually feel pretty good about that. So this is something you can quickly do in your stand-up meetings. You can do this on a regular basis throughout the week and rebalance resources. It's just a really nice tool for doing that. We actually use it internally within our teams as well. You can also start to customize this as well. So because it's based in Excel, you can do all sorts of interesting things. Like you can start bringing in an estimation for the bug debt that you're carrying forward from the previous iteration. So that instead of just assigning 100% of their available time on task hours to work on new work, you may want to say that in this iteration, they can only work on 60% of new tasks because they've got to go clean up bugs from the previous iteration. So really nice things you can do. And we chose Excel because it's so customizable. It's easy to work with there. And so now I can just go ahead and publish this work back to Team Foundation server. And now if I look at the same data using my work item query, you'll notice that it's right there as well. One last thing that I'll show you with project management is a lot of teams like to use Microsoft Project to start creating project plans. And we now have full bidirectional synchronization between Microsoft Project and Team Foundation Server 2010. If you used this in the past, you would have noticed that some of the capabilities to store the data from Project back to Team Foundation Server just simply didn't exist because we didn't have the concept of things like successor and predecessor. Well, now we have that within Team Foundation Server. So what I can do is come into this task, for example, where I'm implementing the web front end. Well, it'd probably be nice if I actually designed that web front end first. So let's say that has a predecessor relationship on number 4. And so now that's going to affect my project schedule. So now if I come back into team and publish this and then return to that particular work item, if I look at my links, you'll notice that it now has a predecessor task. So that's really nice for using Project Professional. A lot of people also like to use Project Server within their enterprise. And so one of the things we released a couple of months ago is integration between Project Server, either 2007 or 2010, and Team Foundation Server 2010. So what you can do there is if you're required to actually take the status of your project and roll it up, of your software project, and roll it up to your central project management office, oftentimes today you probably have to do dual reporting. So you manage your work within Team Foundation Server, and then you go over into this other tool and you manage how that project is coming within Project Server. Well, now with this integration, you can actually set it up so that Team Foundation Server automatically synchronizes the projects that you decide to synchronize with Project Server so that you can run things in an agile fashion within your team, and then that data automatically rolls up so that the bean counters in the PMO office know that you're doing your job, right? So that's kind of nice. So finally, let me talk about what we've done in testing in this release. And testing is really, in my opinion, it's the biggest investment that we've made to Visual Studio 2010. So if you came to my other sessions, you saw some of what we did. For those of you that haven't been exposed to this, let me just take you through the quick story of what we've done with testing in this release. I'm a rock climber, I'm a mountain climber, I live in Seattle, so it's really great for that. And I like to use this analogy because I think it relates to software development really well. When I start training in a given season, and I haven't been to the gym lately, unfortunately, but when I'm getting ready for a climb, I'll go to the gym, you know, every single day, and I'll work on rock climbing skills. I'll work on my conditioning so that when I'm on a glacier, you know, I've got the right conditioning for that. And at that point, the cost of failure in the gym is really, really low. You know, I might jam my finger climbing a wall, or I might, you know, trip off the treadmill. Hopefully not. But the idea is that you're not going to have a serious accident when you're at the gym. But when you get to the point where you're actually climbing and you're out on the mountain and you look behind you, as I did here, and you see that there's this storm cloud moving in. This is the top of a glacier I summited a couple of years ago. And 20 minutes after this photo was taken, we actually got hit by about a 50-mile-an-hour hailstorm. At that point, the cost of failure can be really, really high. It's several hundred feet this direction, several hundred feet sliding off that direction, and you're hoping that all the conditioning that you did and all the testing of your equipment and all the first aid skills you worked on, you're hoping that that pays off, because the cost of failure could mean your life in that scenario. And so software development's really the same thing, right? If we are able to identify a bug while we're developing the software, and, you know, Visual Studio tells us, hey, you've got a compilation error, or hey, this unit test failed, the cost to fix that is really, really low. You know, you're in the zone, you know what files you just changed, I'm working on these files, it must be something having to do with this because it was working 10 minutes ago, and you can make that fix. It maybe costs you 20 minutes of your time. But if it gets out to the customer, and they call you up and they say, hey, you know, my network's down, or hey, you just introduced a security hole into my application and I just lost all this business because my teller machines were down. At that point, you not only have to fix the source code, but you may have to go back and pay compensation to the customer. And so the cost of failure is really, really high. And so that's why we're investing heavily, have been for years, in helping you as developers try to catch bugs right within Visual Studio, IntelliSense, you know, all these different static analysis tools and semantic checkers. But we also want to help testers as well. So if we can catch it in the testing phase, then that means that we're not paying for it by the time it gets out to production. And there's some famous examples of this. Here's the USS Yorktown, which was a smart ship they were developing back in the 90s. They put all these computer systems on board and computerized functions that had never been computerized before. The only problem was they forgot to test it, and so when someone entered a zero into one of the cells, it caused this divide by zero error and brought the whole ship down for two hours, right? So I don't want to be the crewman that entered that zero. I really don't want to be the developer that didn't test for that. Here's another example. This is the Ariane 5, so I'll pick on Europe here. They actually reused some code from Ariane 4, but they took a different flight path, and the math worked out so that they actually had this divide overflow, and that caused the rocket to blow up. So really unfortunate. As I understand it, nobody was hurt, though. There's a really great presentation called An Illustrated History of Failure that was presented at OSCON a few years ago. If you like these types of examples, he looks at all these different types of software examples, and he first starts by saying what the value of a human life is. And it's something like $2 to $3 million in his estimation, based on the number of working people in a population and their gross domestic output. And he says that due to the magic of software, it's now possible to make a single mistake in a single line of code and completely eradicate the value of your human life and even tens or hundreds of thousands of your peers. So this particular error cost $370 million at US prices in 1996, so it's probably about $500 million now. And then here's another story. F-22 Raptor was deploying overseas to Japan. They crossed the international date line, forgot to test for that. All the computers crashed. Luckily, they were able to fly back to Hawaii with no problems. And of course, Microsoft is the largest software developer on the planet, so I've got to pick on us. This is Visual C# 2005 Express Edition. This is the setup. Not exactly sure how I would close that or if I would want to. I'm sure we've all seen this one, right? This file is still copying. An error has occurred while displaying the error that has occurred while creating an error report. See what's wrong with this one? It's missing a period at the end. And then this is my favorite. Okay, right? So this is everybody's problem, right? Everybody needs to, as an industry, improve software quality. And so what we've done with the 2010 release, and I'm not going to demonstrate it here because I've done this in other presentations this week, but what we've done with the 2010 release is we've really taken a look at the entire industry and looked at where software testing can be improved as a whole. And if you look at this diagram, you find that on the left-hand side, this is pure manual testing. So these are people that wake up every day, and they have a list of tests that they need to run, and they run those tests manually and file their bugs. On the right end of the spectrum, you have people that are more specialized in writing code, and they write code to test other code. Maybe they're writing scripts, maybe they're writing C#. At the end of the day, the reality is that 70% of the testing still happens on the manual testing side. And I expect that trend to continue. You know, we can automate a lot of things. We can write a lot of really smart software to do interesting things. I had a session yesterday where I showed how you can write functional UI tests that can help you uncover bugs quickly. The problem with that is not everything is a candidate for automation, and not everything shows a quick positive ROI when you invest in test automation. And so still, at the end of the day, there's no substitute for having a manual tester with a human brain looking at an application and telling you whether or not it's performing correctly. Your application may also change over time, and that could cause automated tests to break, whereas manual testers can say, I know how this is supposed to work. They update the scripts, and they move on. The problem with that is that the majority of the advances in software testing over the last 10, 20 years have really been focused at the right end of the spectrum. You know, count up the number of unit testing frameworks, mocking frameworks, scalability tests that we have out there. I mean, it's just mind-numbing the number of advancements that have been made there and the number of choices we have. But when's the last time you saw a really great tool for manual testers that takes them out of their traditional safety zone of using Word documents and Excel to track all of their test cases? And so that's really what we've tried to do and focus on in this release is we've tried to give the manual testers tools that are built from the ground up specifically for them. And so Microsoft Test Manager is that tool. It helps me manage my test cases, manage my test plans. And then the other thing that happens when a tester finds a bug is they go to a developer and they say, hey, I found this bug, right? And as developers, we're prideful, but we take a look at the bug and we try to reproduce it and we turn around and say, you know what? Works on my machine, right? We've all done that. We've all been guilty. Even in Microsoft, this happens all the time, right? And so the other part of this puzzle is trying to help those testers and developers work better together. And so what we've done in this release is we've made sure that when those testers are running their test cases, that we're actively collecting lots of really interesting information for them so that when they file those bugs back to the developers, you're not just getting a one-line description that says, hey, this is what failed, but you can get a video recording. You can get an IntelliTrace file, which allows you to debug exactly what happened within the application. You can get event logs. You can get system information that says, this is the service pack level the tester was running. What build were they running? And so now you don't have to have this back and forth guessing game, this ping pong match, trying to figure out what the tester did and how that's different from how it works in your environment. You can get that information right at your fingertips. And it's really important to provide that automatically, too, because oftentimes I see this in organizations where developers say, you know what, next time you file these bugs, you need to get these 10 things and fill out these 3-page reports and don't forget the cover sheet, right? And the problem is, as a tester now, I'm like, well, I just found a bug, but do I really want to spend my lunch break filling out all this stuff? And so that's why our tools were built the way that they did, so that you can capture that information automatically. And you can also scale this up for multiple environments as well. So we introduced the ability to scale out your tests and run them on different machines and collect different information from each one of these machines as well. I showed that in my afternoon session. And so I can have an event log that comes from my SQL Server database, a screen recording that comes from the client machine as the tester is running that particular test. And I can change the information I collect off of each one of those machines. I can also create custom packages so that if there's a particular, you know, registry key that gets written or a log file that comes out of my application each time it's run, I can automatically fetch that anytime the tester files a bug, as opposed to relying on the tester to remember to do that for me. And then one last thing is we introduced lab management in 2010. And so lab management allows me to set up this really nice build, deploy, test workflow where I get my source out of Team Foundation Server. I build that on my build server to produce an MSI or a database deployment script. And then I can spin up one or more virtual environments. And a virtual environment can consist of one or more virtual machines. And one might be SQL Server 2008, and the other might be Windows Server 2008 in one environment. And then in another environment, I'm testing SQL 05 and Windows 7. In another environment, I'm testing, you know, you can create your own list of test matrices there. And once we get those environments spin up automatically, we can then take your tests and deploy them into the respective environments, run those tests, automatically report on the status back to Team Foundation Server, and then you come in the morning and you say, okay, this particular test worked fine on this machine, but it failed on this one. Let me understand why, maybe file a bug. If you end up filing a bug, you can then take a snapshot of that virtual environment and you can attach a shortcut that goes to that snapshot so that as a developer, I open up the bug, I look at everything I got in terms of IntelliTrace files, video recordings, all that rich information, and then I can connect straight to a snapshot of that environment where the bug was found. Really, really powerful stuff. I don't have to tell the tester, wait, don't touch your machine. I need to get over there and see what's going on. They can just snapshot that environment, move on with their testing, and then once you're ready as a developer, you connect to it and see exactly what's going on. So that's it for my presentation. I'll stick around. Thank you very much for spending your Friday afternoon with me, and have a great weekend.